This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. In 1955, an African-American teenager named Emmett Till came down from Chicago to visit relatives in the Mississippi Delta. During his trip, Emmett Till was kidnapped and brutally murdered by white men. Soon after the crime, the men responsible were acquitted by an all-white jury. News of the murder spread and eventually helped to spark the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s. Historian Tim Tyson spent years researching the story of Emmett Till. His work includes also the only interview with Carolyn Bryant. And back in 1955, Carolyn Bryant's testimony was at the center of Emmett Till's murder. But in her interview with Tim Tyson, she says that part of that testimony was untrue. Tim has put his research into a new book, and it's called The Blood of Emmett Till. And he will speak at several bookstores across North Carolina in coming weeks. But first, he joins us in the studio now. Tim Tyson, welcome back.
Thanks, Frank. Great to be with you.
Good to have you.
As always.
Well, we think we know a lot about Emmett Till. You decided to write a book about him. Why?
I got a phone call from a nice woman in Raleigh who said she loved Blood Doesn't Sign My Name. My book about North Carolina and race in America and the murder that happened in 1970 under remarkably similar circumstances to the murder of Emmett Till, really. But I was getting off the phone, politely thanking her, but getting off the phone. And she heard that and said, well, my mother-in-law, I gave her the book for Christmas, and she really liked it. And she's coming to town next week, and we'd really like to get together and have a cup of coffee with you. So I pretended she hadn't said that and just was politely and warmly getting off the phone. And she heard that and said, well, you might know about my mother-in-law. Her name was Carolyn Bryant. And, of course, I'm a historian of the civil rights movement in U.S. in the 20th century in the South. So I knew, like anybody of that description, that Carolyn Bryant hadn't said a mumbling word since 1955 about the lynching of Emmett Till, and had never granted an interview, had been pursued by journalists and scholars for decades. And so I allowed I might have time for that in my schedule. And I thought just to interview her, because I'm a historian and that's my job, and I thought I would interview her and put the interview in the archive, and then some historian in the future would be very grateful to me. But that was just my job. So I went to the library to prepare for the interview, and I thought this was a familiar story, that there was lots of history written of it. It was in textbooks that we teach our children. It was in magazines and newspapers and ballads and poems and novels. There's a stack full of stuff. But there was only one history book about the Emmett Till case, which was a flimsy little book and didn't have much research in it. And that was what there was. And so that sort of got me to thinking. I was working on a different book. But then when I talked to Carolyn, her interview opened up enough pieces of the story that we didn't have that I began to think about writing a book. And then over the next few days, looking through my notes, I felt moved to do so.
Remind us and tell us the story we do know of Emmett Till.
We do know. The one that has been told is a story about a horrifying Southern horror movie starring the redneck Frankenstein. And it's basically just that. It's a horrifying story about race and murder, but that's the extent of it, really. And if you look at Eyes on the Prize, say, which is probably the most well-known narrative of Emmett Till's death, it's really almost a suicide by redneck. Because they get to tell the story. After they were acquitted, then they were paid by Look magazine to tell their story, and they had to tell that they had killed Emmett Till or they wouldn't get the money. But everybody assumed that if you could admit to killing a 14-year-old boy, that everything else you say must be true, because why would you lie about that if you told the truth about this? So that was what the narrative rested upon. They told a story of a black boy so dumb that he told them, you know, yes, I've had sex with white women. I'm going to keep on doing it. You know, I'm as good as you, your grandmother, you know, who was mouthing off to them endlessly. You know, it's patently a lie. Hey, this is a boy who's kidnapped at 2 a.m. out of his great uncle and aunt's house by 2 drunken white men with guns. You know, there's no way. I always knew that was not true. But what they didn't tell, they told the story that covered up for their relatives and kinsmen and friends. There was not a murder by two, man. So the story is actually quite different. But more importantly, what the story has left out is not so much the horrifying brutality that was endemic to Jim Crow social order, but what people did with it. You know, this crucifixion story has come without a resurrection story. Right. Nobody ever tells the story of how a courageous and politically astute mother determined to take her private agonies and turn them into a political act, organizes Black Chicago, which has been over the decades has accrued, you know, the most all this Black power, the most powerful Black political machine in the country, the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters and other Black unions, the Packing House Workers of America and other interracial unions that are becoming civil rights unions, a huge NAACP chapter led by labor union militants, the progressive Black and some white churches, all of this strength in Black Chicago becomes a megaphone, turns this into an international story.
To reiterate, Emmett Till came from Chicago. Yes. He was down. He had spent years, so it's not like his first time, for his first visit to the South. But that was part of the narrative, too, that he came down there from Chicago in a place where the law of Jim Crow wasn't quite as explicit, and you know the nuances may not have been known to him, and he sort of stumbles into this nest of white terrorism and doesn't know what hit him.
Yes. And in fact, he had stumbled into a political environment in Mississippi in which African Americans were pushing for voting rights and the integration of schools. Brown versus Board of Education earlier that spring, Black parents organized by the NAACP by the hundreds took petitions to the schools for their children to be enrolled in previously white schools. There were majority Black counties in Mississippi with not a single Black registered voter. Black folks could not vote in Mississippi, and they were pushing to do so. And there were a number of assassinations of Black voting rights activists. That's within a few weeks of when Emmett Till is murdered.
Part of the campaign.
He's almost collateral damage in this furor about race and citizenship.
And voter suppression.
Yes, absolutely.
Voter suppression, which is what happens when with this kind of white anxiety, and we thought it was over forever, and now we're seeing it again in North Carolina.
Right.
I want to get back to Emmett Till's mother, because he does go back to Chicago, and as you say, that's a place. So there was organizing going on in Mississippi, which heightened white tension, the potential loss of white privilege, unearned white privilege through the ballot box. We're going to suppress the Black vote. That's happening in Mississippi. Emmett Till is brutally killed, and then his mother doesn't let this story die, because, of course, there had been other lynchings in the South, and they didn't get this kind of attention. Tell us about her efforts, the attention that it brought, and the effect that it had.
She insisted that the body be brought back to Chicago from Mississippi, the mangled, bloated, horrifying body of her son be brought back to Chicago for an open casket funeral. Before the body even got there, she began calling reporters. And so when the body arrives at the train station, she is there, but hundreds of other people are there and lots of reporters. Somewhere between 100,000 and 250,000, depending on which reports you believe, but people came and viewed the body at the funeral home. What unrolled from that is this global news story.
The photograph makes Jet Magazine.
Right, because of this. Yeah, Jet Magazine, but also the Soviet Union and the United States are grappling for control of the whole world, which is mostly dark-skinned. And America's big problem is its own racial domestic politics, where the Soviets are turning to the people of color all over the world and saying, you call this democracy? Mm-hmm. Showing them a picture of Emmett Till's battered body and other such atrocities. So this becomes an international crisis for American foreign policy. It becomes a political crisis across the country. It builds the infrastructure that turns, and at that point, what we think of as the civil rights movement is a series of local movements all over the South, local people struggling for equality. But it's not a news story. These are isolated movements. Mm-hmm. what happens with the Till story is it becomes a national news story and it becomes a national movement. The movement to protest the lynching of Emmett Till and the acquittal of two of its killers, it turns into this national movement that funds the Montgomery bus boycott. A few days, Dr. T.R.M. Howard from Mississippi, who is one of the grassroots activists around the Till case, he is invited to speak by Martin Luther King at Dexter Memorial Baptist Church. There's a woman named Rosa Parks in the congregation. She's deeply moved. 4 days later, she's arrested on a bus in Montgomery because, as she said, I thought about Emmett Till and I could not move. You know,
yeah, but you make the point, and yes. You've already made it implicitly, but let's make it explicit, that there was a civil rights movement underway. It was a long civil rights movement that began decades earlier and was and manifest in many, many ways.
Yes.
This was a spark that brought things together, but you and no one else would say this started the civil rights movement. I know you're not saying that, but I want to make that clear.
It depends on what you mean. People say civil rights movement. I always want to go, well, which one? We're talking about a black freedom struggle that really takes place over centuries. But in the 20th century, there are lots of surges. But in the post-war, in post-war America, political conditions changed and made it more conducive. And all of these local movements, because of the Till case, came together and became what we think of as the civil rights movement. Also, it's very important that the young people who coming out of North Carolina in 1960 organized the sit-in movement that spread across the South, that really turns this into a mass movement rooted in nonviolent direct action and driven by youth. That movement was people, they were all Emmett Till's age. They were 15 and 14 in 1955. Every single one of them that I've interviewed, you know, one and many others call themselves the Emmett Till generation. Yeah. They all know where they were when they saw that picture in Jet magazine. And Julian Bond and Charlie Cobb and Joyce Ladner and Bob Zell, all these people say that experience, the brutality and the injustice of that, John Lewis writes about it in his autobiography, led them to join the civil rights movement.
We have to get back to Carolyn Bryant now.
Yes.
That's how we began. Let's talk about her testimony and what changed and how she talked to you about that testimony. Yes.
I've been a little surprised that people have been so interested to know that she lied in court. You know,
and you're going to have to give us that testimony. Tell us what she said, because it's relevant, because somehow in a case where she talks about the overtures that he made to him,
yes,
and the gestures, which weren't illegal, would have possibly justified the homicide. That's the first of all. It's even if she was telling the truth, you can't kill somebody because they did that. And yet this becomes kind of pivotal testimony in this case.
Tell us
what she said.
Not really. It isn't really pivotal. The judge actually will not let it be. Let her testify in front of the jury. Hmm. They removed the jury from the courtroom. Of course, the defense knows that the jury is going to hear about it.
Yeah, right.
They also, after she testifies in court, and what she testifies to is essentially that he'd come in, ask her for a date, grabbed her hand over the counter, asked for a date, come around the counter, grabbed her around the waist with both hands, spoke filth to her, told her he had sex with white women before. She wouldn't even say what letter the word began with, and that she got away from him with great difficulty. She described a sexual assault would be what it would be, you know, legally. So she left the store, went out the front door, got a pistol from underneath the seat of her sister-in-law's car, and then he whistled at her. You know, some of that's true, most of it's not. The story that she was telling, though, was a very familiar narrative. It was a narrative created at the turn of the 20th century to justify lynching, to justify any length of violence or repression against black people and their disfranchisement from voting, which was a story about the black beast rapist and the southern white fairest flower of southern white womanhood. You know, it was an old narrative that was already in the heads of everybody. They didn't have to tell the jury this, but she testified to that story. But a few days after the incident, when her husband had been arrested, she was interviewed by the family attorney, and he took very careful and clear notes about what her story was. And what she described then was a boy that insulted her, a boy that was rude, a boy that was annoying or infuriating, really. He violated her racial sensibilities, that's right. Clear. But there's no mention of anything physical, sexual, or menacing in her account in private to her attorney. But then a couple of weeks later, she tells this story of the Black Beast rapist.
And I've got about a minute left. What did she tell you?
She said, well, that part's not true. She was referring to the physical
sexual assault
account. And she also, I think, you know, said, in her words, nothing that boy did could ever justify what happened to him. But, you know, to my mind, what speaks to us now when we're in the middle of this crisis of democracy that's got its roots in fear and resentment, rooted in race and the changing shape of race in America, embodied in a Black president, changing gender roles, you know, the role of women has changed. Then when we're looking at that, the question and this and violence and injustice and violence, police violence, what I want to say is, you know, here we have a situation where this horror occurred and people rose up and created a movement to topple that. And my question is, what are we going to do now? Can we manage to come together and create that movement that's so necessary at this moment?
And hopefully we can do it without the need to produce another battered body. We can do it in time. Tim Tyson, as always, a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Good to talk to you, Frank. Thanks so much.
Tim Tyson's a historian and author. The new book, The Blood of Emmett Till, going to be at the Regulated Bookshop in Durham tonight at 7. Many other bookstores across North Carolina. I encourage you to go to our website and find out more. stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton Ormond, and Laura Pelliser. Robin Copley is our technical director, Brent Wolf, WNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.